Hello and welcome to another analysis interview with me, Chris Darwin. And today I am joined by an incredibly experienced coach. And I've been looking forward to this interview for a little while now. We tried to line it up last season, but for various reasons, we couldn't get our diaries to match. But we've both got time now to sit back and have a good old chat about all things analysis, what it means in the current age of analysis, whilst leaning on the experience that my guest has got today. I'm delighted to be joined by Steve Darby. Steve, great to have you on. As I say, we've been trying to do this for a while, but how are you?
Great. Locked in, shall we say. So it's a perfect chance to do a podcast. Boris has said we've got to stay in, so it's obviously the intelligent thing to do. And sadly, football coaching is not an emergency occupation. So I can sit here and talk to you nonstop.
Well, exactly. We've both got a bit of spare time today, as a result. So we'll probably have a good old natter for the next hour or so, and see where it takes us. But Steve, as I always say to any guest who comes on, most people who listen to us will know who you are and your background. But there will also be quite a few people who won't. So would you mind just spending a few minutes at the start here, just to let us know a little bit more about who you are, what your background is, and basically why you're going to be able to add value to this conversation today?
Well, basically, I'm someone who's a football fanatic at heart, love the game, and I take the view as well, if you to make it as a pro in any level, you've got to love it first. So I was lucky enough to be born on Anfield Road. Literally, I went to Anfield Road school, so I went past the ground every day. Lucky enough to be brought up when Shankly was almost like God, and again, lucky enough to meet him in person. Played football. Reality, my career was cut short by a severe lack of ability, I might say.
I love the honesty.
So realistically, I wanted to be a pro. That's all that mattered to me. I was with a pro club. They quite correctly told me stay on to go to uni because I had the A levels, etc. So I ended up going to Carnegie College to do a phys ed degree, where I was lucky enough to meet a guy called Merv Beck, who taught me what coaching was, because even though I'd been at a pro club, I was never coached there. And he actually showed me how to coach, and that opened a whole new world to me. And I did my FA prelim, it was called. Then later did my full badge. And another reality of football is that there's luck in the game. There's bad luck and good luck. I had an opportunity to go to Bahrain when I was 23 to be a player coach of a club there, East Rifar, and then also work with the national team when the league closed down. So that was a chance of a lifetime. I'd just done my full badge. Apparently, I was the third youngest to do it at 24. So I don't know if that's true, but I've been told this. And people like Alan Wade took it, Howard Wilkinson, they were the type of people who were lecturing to me when I was taking these badges. And then it just literally went from there. I just kept on going from contract to contract to contract. And the reality is, if you're in professional football, there's really only one thing that matters, and that's winning. So at the beginning, I could say, and rather than the end, forget your philosophies, your projects. All that matters, particularly in Asia, where I spent most of my time, it's winning. Long-term is next week. Development means winning by a bigger score. So don't let anyone kid you.
Fantastic. And Steve, give us a flavour of some of the other clubs and national sides that you've been involved in over the years.
Well, it was Bahrain. Then I went, I got an offer to go to Tasmania, and I thought, wow, I thought, great, I've never been to Africa. And then it dawned on me after looking at the map where it was. Next stop was the Antarctic. I couldn't get any further south than Tasmania, but it was a great place. And I mean, and the reality is, again, I only had one offer at that time. So I took that one offer. And I always remember getting off the plane in Launceston, and the media was there. I want to say the media, that was one person. And he said to me, can I walk down the steps of this small plane with the sponsor's bag over my shoulder, juggling a ball? And I thought, mate, if I could do that, it'd be Madrid Airport. it wouldn't be Launceston. But it was a great place. I learned a lot about coaching there, because I had to deal with, I've learned that basically you coach people. You don't coach players. And if you can't coach people, you'll never get to the player anyway. So that was the start of the learning curve of away from the courses, which are, I think, essential and were really useful, your football content and your organizational content. But to survive, you've got to be able to coach people.
Fantastic.
And then after Australia, I did 17 years in Australia. I ended up like national youth director. The terms change all the time now. Then again, there was looking. I got sacked from a club. I was coaching at a club there called Sydney Olympic, and I joined a majority. I got sacked. And as a couple of famous coaches have said to me, you're not a real coach till you get sacked. And the reality is, you're either going to get sacked or you're going to leave. So you've got, it's going to happen to everybody. And I got a break. A mate of mine called Ron Smith said to me, did I fancy a 6-week contract in Malaysia? And when they told me how much money it was, I would have swam to Malaysia from, I was at Sydney at the time. Again, this is where winning comes into it. We won the Malaysian FA Cup, and that 6-week contract was suddenly became another 2-year extension. And then we went on to win the league. And then, again, got sacked in my third year there. And so, because, I was only fourth in the league in that third year. So, and it just went from step by step. To, ended up in Vietnam. Then I came back to England for Sheffield Wednesday, which was disappointing in a way. Not the club. The club were great. People I was working with were great. People like Terry Yorath, Willie Donaghy, Martin Hodge. But I was putting in 80 hours a week in the academy, in the youth section, freezing every day, winter. And then I got offered Singapore to go out there on 4 times the salary to work basically 2 or 3 hours a day.
And Terry Yorath said to me, in a warmer climate, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah. And Terry Yorath said to me, he'd been in Lebanon. He said, don't be stupid. You're never going to be a first team coach here. And he was right. He wasn't being horrible. I hadn't played. I didn't have 200 games under my belt for somebody or an international cap. So I knew it wasn't going to hit. The brick wall was going to be hit there. Whether that be right or wrong, it's a reality. So went to Singapore, did well. You've got to do well. And we won the league and the cup and things like this. And that ended up going to Malaysia. Did 7 years in Malaysia, different clubs. Loved Malaysia. Went to Thailand, worked with Peter Reid and Brian Robson, which was an education in itself, two real good football men. And then sort of did a bit in India, which was either brilliant or awful, depending on which place I went to. Some horror stories from India, but also some wonderful stuff going on there. And when that gets organised, that should be a fantastic country for football. And sort of the last real job was Laos with the national team, which sort of, it was only Laos, and people say that, but it still meant a lot to them. And I actually worked in the World Cup, in the qualifiers, which on a personal, selfish level, yeah, it was like professionally, I wanted to work in the highest level I could. And I think the World Cup, it obviously is. Now, we were never going to get to the World Cup per se, but we got to the qualifiers, played against Korea, got battered, but Kuwait, Myanmar, Lebanon. So, and we got some of like the first ever World Cup points, which meant something to the people of Laos.
Of course.
And I there discovered that four of my, this is where analysts don't really come into it too much, but four of my starting 11 were banned for life after I left. Two I guessed were fixing people. I couldn't drop them because of the two best players in their positions. And as they later said to me, coach, we don't fix in real games, we only coach in fixing friendlies. And then two more who I would have put my house on, being honest, and I'd have lost my house, it would appear, because they were caught and accused of fixing. I'm wow. Still skeptical about one. I think one is honest and has been stitched up. But, again, it's so difficult to prove.
Well, that's a journey and a half, Steve. I think it's, trying to think of the right word to add to that, but I don't think I can think of one. It's
enjoyable. A lot of right place, right time.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of who you know. Don't let anyone kid you. It's not. So it's really important if young coaches are listening to build contacts.
Build contacts,
and also to treat people well, because you never know where you're going to meet them again. 99% of coaches I've got on with, they're good lads. We all have good mates. We're all in the same boat. I never slag another coach publicly because we have enough enemies in the media and in the boardroom, so we don't need to do that. And I've only seen two coaches who do that. And fortunately, they ran out of work. They ran out of places to go because the word spreads. So do the right thing by each other. If you don't like some, just shut your mouth. You don't need to say anything about each other. That's probably the best way. Just don't say nothing about them because starve them of the oxygen of publicity.
Well, indeed. Okay, so well, look, we're here to talk about analysis sort of primarily, obviously, but I know we're going to touch on many different things, and we already have with your suspicions and disappointments around match fixing in your last role. But I really want to it's probably the best time now for me to introduce the theme of today's podcast to our listeners, so they understand where we're going to be going with this. Now, you've said to me several times over our conversations over the last year or so about how you've got a foot in both camps when it comes to analysis. So would you mind by starting us off by explaining what you mean by that phrase, a foot in both camps?
Yeah, realistically, when I first started coaching, there was basically no analysis. I don't remember. And also remember when I first coached, there was no internet. And to show how real, there was no actual mobile phones. So there was no method of analysis then, other than the famous pencil and paper, which I did use. So basically, though, in the mid-90s, I was coaching some of the national team goalkeepers in Australia and at a national league club. And I wanted to make my sessions better for the goalkeeper. You know, all the goalkeepers, there's about three of them. And I wanted to do good sessions. So I thought, let's see how are goals scored, I thought. I mean, I wanted to realise if goals are going in, that's what they've got to stop. So I thought, I did an analysis of a whole season at National League. Then I started to get interested in it. And I looked at international football, and I used pencil, paper, and then in those days, VHS, which was just coming out. So that's how we had to start. And, you know, press pause, go back. But the thing is, it worked. And I found out at every level in football, the same reality was happening, that 80% of the goals roughly came from in the penalty box. 90% were one or two touch. Set pieces range between 30 and 40, depending on the level. So I started inventing practices which I felt were relevant, where all the shots on the keeper were in the box. They were one touch or two touch. And it turned out these practices ended up great practices for strikers as well, because they suddenly were doing work, was how they were getting it. So you'd see often, and you still see to this day, which is sad, you know, the boys line up in a queue, they knock it into a coach, edge of the D, he lays it off and they shoot. That doesn't happen in a game ever. All it means is the coach laying off gets better at laying off. Lads can often take 3.5-4 minutes before they get another go, and especially if they have to go and get the ball themselves. And in a big stadium, I've seen that happen at international level, even up in 2016, 2017, this was going on. So, you know, I wanted to be better than that. So, you know, I did that, and I started to read about as much as I could. And at the time, there was a fellow called Charles Hughes, and he wrote.
I was going to mention Charles Hughes at this point because, yeah, it's a lot of what you've described there sounds like there was certainly early parts of this in his coaching manual that he wrote for the FA.
Oh, I mean, there was two manuals at the time. Alan Wade just spoke about the principles of the game, and you know, he was on my full badge. And Charles Hughes, who I didn't get on my badge, but I read all his stuff, tactics and teamwork and work, you know, things like this. And it's a top-class book, by the way. Don't let anyone kid you that it's not. Some of the people who played in it, as a demonstration models, you know, Shilton, Keegan, Brooking, Robson, you know, these are the top level, superb quality camera work on the videos, and what he says applied. But he used things like analysis, you know, and he got much maligned for it, saying that, you know, you don't need to pass the ball as much. So he looked at things like the POMO, position of maximum opportunity, which basically is the gap, you know, between the 6-yard box and the 12-yard box, where most goals come from. And he got this from research, from analysis. And he based some of his work on a fellow called Reap, who in the, apparently the 20s and the 30s, was doing this with a pencil and a paper before anybody. I've never seen his work in original form. I've tried to, but I've read about Reap's work. So if anyone's doing a master's in analysis, which apparently you can do now, which I saw recently on Google, they should start looking at Reap and see what he did.
Well, a lot of Reap's work seemed to transfer over to the early stuff that Dave Bassett was doing at Wimbledon as well, because they were early exponents of video analysis and anything to gain an advantage. And a little bit like Charles Hughes himself, a lot of the good stuff that they actually did behind the scenes seems to have got lost in translation over the years, and a completely different picture has been painted.
Well, Charles Hughes, he basically... They kept saying to him, you know, they got on this Brazilian theme, or you're criticizing Brazil, which he wasn't. He just said, you know, the simple analysis, the more men you get in the box, the more likely to score. The more times you get in the box, the more likely to score. And then the value of set pieces.
And that seems to make logical sense to anyone who's football, watching football.
Yeah, and basically... The game is a game of opposites, as we know. So if you're defending, and as a, you know, the keeper, ex-keeper, I like defending, the more men you can get in the box defending, the less they can get in their box, and the less stupid free kicks you give away, the less chance of getting goals against you. So, I mean, that's something I've really, really punished over the years, is stupid free kicks. I'm not an angel in saying don't foul. I'm saying foul at the right place at the right time, which I think Man City do very well. If you're going to analyse someone for it, you know, the breakaway foul on the halfway line. But I always remember Eddie Thompson, who was a coach of Australia when we played Argentina in 93. And his basic, one of his words was, don't kick Diego. Which sounds easy, but as a lad who was marking him said, I couldn't get within 5 yards of Diego, never mind, you know, kick him. So, because you're scared stiff, if you give a free kick away against some players, that means a shot on target, which is stupid to give away. So I really go on about, you know, don't give away. You can't stop corners all the time, you know, you can't stop throw-ins. But I also think it's very important what Jurgen Klopp's done. He's got this throw-in coach. Because you get so many throw-ins in the game, you may as well keep the ball from a throw-in, not just give it away stupidly. So I don't insult that idea of people laughed at a throw-in coach. Well, okay, at some stage I might be called a dinosaur, but I don't think Klopp's a dinosaur, and I don't think Guardiola, I think they're top-class coaches. And I think they use people like this to say, well, let's get the advantage that... analysis, you know, how many throw-ins you get in a game, how many you keep, how many you lose, that's analysis. You know, that's where the analysis, the value of it is, I think, top class.
But then again, and we talk about, because you're right, when it came out that Klopp had hired Thomas Groenemark, the throw-in coach, people were like, oh yeah, here we go, this is just another one of those things that we can sort of point the finger of fun at, which does seem to be still the case in football when there's a new idea that doesn't quite fit into the traditional box. And we rewind the clock back to the 80s. And again, when you mentioned the likes of Charles Hughes and the work that Reap did, and even probably some of the work that you started doing in the early stages of your sort of a interest in analysis, this wasn't what people were doing at the time. And it was a little bit different. So therefore, of course, people who don't seem to understand it and might feel like things might be starting to change a little bit, one of the default settings that we seem to have as human beings is that we make a bit of fun of it, or we try to damage its credibility, or we just keep it as far away from, we're all right over here, guys, we don't need to do any of this newfangled stuff type approach. And yeah, you quite rightly say, you can go back and look at Liverpool, and we've done this on the website and maybe in the magazine as well, where we've actually gone back over Liverpool and set pieces, and it is abundantly clear that they've spent a lot of time analysing and working on, and then taking that analysis onto the training field and coming up with something that works for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally true. And this is where my foot's starting now to creep over to the other side a little bit. The reality is sometimes you don't have a chance to work on your set piece because you haven't got time, or your best player does his foot in the warm-up, you know, pulls a hammy. So often a lot of set pieces that go in are totally unplanned. And I read Graeme Souness a great deal, because I think he speaks a lot of sense about football. And he spoke about Liverpool, where basically they virtually did no coaching. They just played five a side and got fit. And set pieces were just ad hoc. Who fancied it, took it. And their success rate was incredibly high. So that's where the danger of is overanalyzing. And another example of overanalyzing was, I took it further as I got more and more interested in analysing the game. I started to look at my players, and this took a long time. Again, pencil, paper, drawing little boxes on a piece of paper with the VHS about good pass and bad pass. And the good pass I defined as it went to your teammates, bad pass it didn't go to your teammates. And then I started to realise that, well, your fullbacks and your centre-backs are going to make loads of good passes because no pressure on them if the team dropped off. And I suddenly realized, I looked at Barcelona and I thought, well, yeah, all the best teams in the world at the time were having their centre-backs, you know, massive amount of possession and quality possession. And it was because other sides weren't pressing them. They were dropping off, letting them play. So they were playing round at the back. And then I suddenly saw some great players didn't have a 100% possession because they were trying something a bit special. I'll use the phrase number 10s, you know, but people like Maradona, Coutinho, you know, these type of players who could see things, Kevin De Bruyne, and not always were they, you know, getting the perfect score because they tried things that were maybe just cut out, or, you know, it was a wonderful pass when it worked and it got a goal, or it didn't come off because of great defending, or just slightly went the other way. So that became a bad pass. So I had to temper what I was doing with my analysis to find out, well, I had to start making decisions. Was it a good pass if it succeeded? And I've got to be honest, it became too complex. You know, so I stuck to the simple stuff that I knew. And you realise then that maybe if you have someone, if you're playing a four in midfield, if you're two in midfield, if one is a, you know, a journeyman who keeps the ball and doesn't give it away, then that's great. He can carry the lad who can play a bit and can see things, and, you know, who can try the bits of magic which sometimes separate your team from the next one.
And that's where, for me, the levels of context need to come in, because where we see things on a pitch and we see things on a spreadsheet and we see things here and we see things there. But unless you've got the context of the actual situation in there as well, a lot of these statistics and data, they don't tell you much other than just being numbers without context. Tom Warville on The Athletic wrote something fantastic yesterday, basically lining out his 10 commandments for sort of soccer analytics. And a lot of what he was talking about was making the data contextual. Because as you say, if somebody gets a 99.9% pass completion rate, well, what does that actually tell you? It tells you nothing if he's playing centre-back, as you say, and he's not under pressure. But it would tell you a hell of a lot if he was playing centre midfield against the team that was pressing the living daylights out of him all the time. So there's so many levels of context that has to go into this stuff, surely.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's frustrating in a way when you see some of the analysis and the way it's applied. It happens as well when I was a staff coach conducting coaching courses, mainly in Australia, and did some work for the AFC on this. You'd have people, we were laying out like systems of play sometimes, and we'd use indoor sessions on a table and using bottle tops, and you'll show that system. And then you found out people who could understood football because things like distance. The ones who didn't understand football say, well, you knock a ball in there and the player goes there. And the reality is the player physically cannot get from A to B, you know, in that time. You know, the ball goes so much faster than the player. Mm. So things they were looking at were physically impossible on a pitch, but they work great with bottle tops on a tabletop, you know. But so that started to prove to me, and when I started to read some of the things in the analysis magazines that have come out, I'll say in the last 3 or 4 years, really, because I've been inundated with analysis. It's almost, you know, analysis by paralysis. I've seen some of the people, and I'm thinking, no, you haven't played, you haven't coached. Now, I'm not saying you've got to be the best player in the world, because in that case, only Maradona or Baresi or Pele, you know, et cetera, would be coaching. And some of them didn't make it as coaches. So it's that I'm not from this school of thought says you've got to be a great player, but I think you've got to play a lot, you know, at any level. Because the more you play, the more you understand the game, even at a low level. So, you know, I'll be quite blunt. I read your latest magazine and I saw some stuff by a kid who's 18. Now, it was like a football chess. And having looked at it, you know, it was not all wrong and rubbish. I couldn't understand a lot of it, I've got to be honest. And I'll talk later about terminologies. Here you had an 18-year-old discussing how teams break down the press. Now, good on the kid. I'm delighted that he loves football that much. He's obviously working very hard at what he's doing. But a lot of it, I felt, was unrealistic. You know, players don't do what he was saying. They don't think as quickly as he was saying, you know, the double pivot, horrible phrase that anyway, and vertical penetration. You know, so players don't think that quick. Often on a pitch, it just happens. Now, that's why you practice, because if you do things like shadow play, you know, where 11 play none, you just get into habits. Because the reality is, if you're right back, there's only so many passages you're going to make in a game to certain people. So you know that, so you practice it in shadow play. You know, and the centre midfield is going to make others. I mean, I look a lot at Liverpool now, and they must be an analyst's dream, because they're so simple what they do. They're repetitive. They keep the same shape when they can. They have the odd bit of improvisation. Someone like Sadio Mane, who he does things you shouldn't do, and sometimes that's why he scores. You've got someone super intelligent like Firmino. His dropping off and his running, it is magnificent. You know, he makes holes for people. You have Mohamed Salah, who looks like a cheat sometimes. He stands still, doesn't do anything. But when he goes, my God, he goes at pace and power, how strong he is. So, you know, you have different ways of looking at teams. You look at Fabinho, who's just like a piece, like a metronome. He just gets the ball and gives it, gets the ball and gives it. He's your classic possession player, but he's valuable, you know. And why does Alexander Arnold and Robertson get forward so much? Because they've got a fella called Van Dijk at the back who is out of this world and can read the game, can cover, and is a great athlete. So Adam Gomez is on the way to becoming another Van Dijk, I think. So it really does show, you know, where analysis can be important. And I saw teams try to beat Liverpool by putting wide men to stop Arnold and Robertson getting forward, you know. And so people do use match analysis. They do use it. So, again, the dinosaur, maybe I am to some people, but I've got to try and balance what is practical analysis, useful analysis, as opposed to just sheer academic analysis.
And that's a really interesting point around the point of analysis is eventually to be something that is relevant and usable to a coach. Otherwise, as you say, it does become just an academic paper. Now, let's say if you are a young coach and you are analytically thinking and you do see a game in a certain way, which at a young age I do think is an incredibly good thing and can be used for good in the future, how would you advise a young coach looking to learn the ropes, so to speak, and then making the ideas that are forming in your head, how to turning them into more relevant, practical parts to your coaching game, shall we say?
All right. Well, near the end of my career, I was lucky enough to have staff who were analysis staff. Beginning of my career, you didn't have the staff, did it yourself. So in the end, you started to have people. Now, what I wanted from that person was, I didn't want their opinion. I wanted objective analysis, because unless I knew the bloke and I knew he had a good track record and understood the game, opinion is irrelevant because it might be wrong. I want objective stuff. And what I wanted from my analyst was, I wanted basically the team shape. This is of the opposition. I wanted their shape. Do they play 4-3-3, 4-4-2? You know, just the general shape, because that will then imply where they're going to be on the pitch. I want to do set pieces. Do they do short corners? Do they have do they all run to the near post and the big centre back peels off at the back? I want to know their set pieces. who takes them? Who takes the free kicks? Are they left footers, right footers? Because that was, there's 40% of your goals. So if you can stop that 40%, it's good. Have they got a star player? You know, have they got someone who is a little bit special? What can you do to stop them? If it was a case of, I knew Son Heung-min was the star player for Korea against Lao, and it, what we tried didn't work. We tried to kick him on the halfway line. Because, you know, I'll be quite honest, I said to my lad, don't kick him near the goal, because he was a fantastic free kick player. I said, just give him a few kicks on the halfway line. I was hoping he'd go off, because he had a Premier League game at the weekend, and he might think, oh, I better get off and look after myself.
Yeah.
He didn't. And not only didn't, the lad didn't kick him either, because he couldn't get near him, you know, and he scored three and made two. And so Son Heung-min was, you know, beat Lau on his own. But I've got to say as well, at the end of the game, he was magnificent. He came up laughing, smiling, gave his shirts to the lads. A really, really nice lad, a top pro he was, you know. So the other thing I'd look for is, just, you know, so that's what I want. That's the basic of what I want. And things like, do they play, I won't say high or this medium block and all these things, because I don't like the language like that. But do they push up for offside, for example? Well, if they all push up for offside, then certain people are going to be more involved, and certain players are going to make certain other runs. And I'll put this in practical terms. I was coaching in Malaysia, and I had a striker who was a great striker who could score goals, but he was thick. I mean, in the nicest possible way. He had no concept of football. He was a magnificent athlete. And we played a team who pushed up to get everyone offside. And he kept getting caught offside. I mean, middle and midfielder, who was very intelligent, international Malaysian player, literally had his foot on the ball, screaming at him, get back, get back. And he couldn't understand it. So we couldn't do anything while the game was going on, because you can't do it. We got him in at half time, and I put him into midfield, me striker. And he made the same runs from deep, from his own half. The centre midfield picked him out then. So that's the type of thing you've got to be able to analyse. And another example of being able to analyse on the hop, I was with Thailand against Saudi Arabia. And we went there, and within 3 minutes, I said to Peter Reid, it's the fullbacks we've got to stop, because they were playing, they had a back four, then they played 2-2-2. So it was almost like six in the middle, you're going up the pitch. But the two boys on the fullbacks, they were literally flying up and down. And if you stop the two fullbacks, you had a chance of stopping the rest. You know, to an extent that actually worked. We only got beat 1-0 by Saudi, which was quite an achievement, you know, to be fair. And we pushed our wide midfielders onto the fullbacks after 10 minutes. And to an extent, it did work.
Steve, I just want to ask a question there, because that's interesting. So then, what shape were you playing initially there with Thailand?
We were playing like a 4-4-1-1. Really, yeah. Was 4-5-1.
Sure.
The one he was meant to pick off the lone striker, you know, lay off him and get him, support him.
Yeah.
The reality of getting the ball was he basically was in the further back into the midfield four to make it a 4-5-1.
And then you literally just pushed the wider midfield players up into closer
onto the fullbacks. Yeah. I mean, that was what we had to do, because we saw that the Brazilians called it the box midfield. Yeah. Where they had, you know, four in midfield, but not in a diamond, not spread out wide, but in like a box shape. And, you know, it worked for them, especially if you've got two magnificent fullbacks. It would work with Liverpool, because you've got two magnificent fullbacks, you know. So that's where, you know, you would use it. Now, what you've got to look at is, I've had people analysing, especially as it goes, like I say, higher in the national team, I had analysis companies or individuals sending me examples of their work using my team. They're based off either at the game or off TV. And obviously, long term, they wanted employment, which is fine. I've got no hassles with that. Or they wanted payments. So, okay. So they had to send me stuff that was, to me, useful. And some of the stuff, I had blogs telling me where my game plan went wrong. Again, I've got no problem if it did go wrong, but they basically had no idea what my game plan was. I'll give you a reality of we played it when you we played in the World Cup. The first game we played, to come home, we had to get a plane 2 days later, not one day, because the planes weren't running properly. It poured down the day in the middle. The official training, we couldn't go on the pitch because it was underwater. So we never had a gap. And I'd lost a couple of players from injury from the first game. So in that gap, we had no game plan, literally. But I was told that the analysis said, I'd done this and it failed. I'd tried that and it failed. Well, it might have failed what we did, but it wasn't a plan because we didn't have one. And that's, you know, at the highest level, that can still happen. You know, if certain players get injured, sometimes the whole game plan goes to the wall. So the person who understands football, who understands analysis, has got to know that. So that's the danger. If I was a young lad on the way up, I'd be playing five-a-side with my mates. I'd be going to play in the park. I'd be watching everything I can, you know, and just watching things all the time or playing as much as I can. Because when you play, you see things. It's so much more important, you know, if you're seeing things. So that would be my advice to a young coach or a young analyst, you know, play. It's the best teacher in the world is playing. Listen to people, of course, you know. I used to listen to people, listen to Shankly, you know, but I've listened recently. I went to a lecture with Guardiola, and he was wonderful. He was actually speaking about Catalan independence, not football, but he was still a wonder. You could see what an intelligent man. And I look at Klopp and I think, yeah, I'd like to play for you. You know, I'd run through a brick wall, you know. And so there are certain things, you know, that apply to coaching, certain things I think apply to analysis, but keep playing, get as much experience as you can.
It's interesting that you've mentioned both Klopp and Guardiola there, who are obviously two at the moment of the highest performing coaches in world football. But it also ties in for me with a phrase you used earlier in the conversation around coach the person, not the player. Because when I look at both of those guys, and I see this a lot in good leaders in business as well, I feel that they've got that ability to connect with individuals. And you can tell that they can do that because they don't just do it with the players that they're working with. They do it with the people in the media. They do it with the people in the club who aren't on the playing staff. You just get that feeling that they are empathetic towards the needs of human beings. Now, that for me seems to be, it's obviously been a part of coaching all the way through. You can go all the way back to the likes of Bill Shankly, of Sir Matt Busby, et cetera, et cetera. They also seem to have that ability to communicate and connect with human beings before going anywhere near coaching and tactics and analysis and this, that, and the other. But when you see Klopp and Pep in action, you just get the feeling that there is just that they care about a person, and that probably then gets them more buy-in from the individuals they're working with, which then opens them up to be able to then talk about more sort of technical things, strengths, weaknesses. Could you do this? Could you do that type stuff? Because they've got that connection there. Is that something that you've encountered with different coaches at different levels throughout your sort of career?
Oh, with that, I mean, the reality is, say you've got 25 in your squad, 11 think you're a genius because you pick them.
Indeed,
Five think maybe you're a genius because they might get on, and the rest think you're idiot because you haven't picked them, you know, so then they want to play. But when I've got that 11 as well, what I've got in that 11, I've got 11 buttons to press on each person. And if I press the right button, I get a great player. I get, you know, highly motivated, enthusiastic. I mean, the ability is a different factor. You know, it turns out level you're at. But, you know, but if you get the heart and the mind going for you, you've got a head start. I can't say that I've always got pressed 11 buttons right. You know, there's been teams where literally I've had good players who just didn't like me. Oh, and to be honest, I didn't like them. You know, so, and that can happen. You don't have to like them as people. Usually you have to be able to make them want to play well. You know, as a team called Home United, I had, it was the closest team I've ever been amongst. There was a massive mixture of races, of religions, but there wasn't a minute's problem off the pitch or in the dressing room. And that was helped, I think, by having top-class local players who were good leaders. I had two fantastic, tough leaders who were locals, and my foreigners were good characters. Because that is something which you might call this analysis as well, but coaches are doing now. When you sign a player, you might look at his stats, and you might look at his physical stats as well. You know, can he run? Because if you can't run at the highest level, you sadly can't play now. But also you look at the, do you analyse his character? Is he a good lad? Is he going to fit in the dressing room? You know, or is he a, has he got a track record of leaving clubs every year? Why is he leaving clubs? You know, is he a drinker? You know, is he, does he take drugs? Is he a fixer? You know, all these things now coming. And I think analysis plays a part in that as well, analysing a person's character. Now, I don't know how you do it. I don't know if there's a, I'm sure there are people out there who can, psychologists, etc. But that's, to me, a really important part of analysis. How do you sign a player? What do you look at, as well as his physical stats? Do you look at his personality? And you're right. You know, Shankly obviously seem to push everyone's right button. Klopp seems to be doing it now. You never hear people moaning who are not in Klopp's first 11. You know, so, and the squad that Guardiola's got, you know, the internationals on the bench are magnificent. So they must be doing something right. So that's what you've got to look at. Yeah, all the areas, and working on people first. I mean, I've had players who I just didn't like, I'll be honest, because I found they were selfish. To be fair, they've been usually been foreigners. And then I had one player who was extremely selfish. He wanted a goal bonus. And I said to him, no, you're not getting a goal bonus, because you will try and take a corner and shoot, you know, and things like this. You'll shoot from the byline. You won't pass it to anybody. I said, I'll give you a team bonus. When the team wins and we all get the same bonus together. And I said, and I used to do things like have the kit man on the same bonus as the striker, so that he was an important part of the whole club to me. And the physio, because if the physio wasn't putting the striker on the pitch, we could lose. So it was really important about, you got this team concept, as opposed to some of the selfish players I've had. Then again, I had a lad who was an African player. I'll be, you know, be quite blunt about it. He was a lovely lad, highly intelligent, spoke 5 languages, trained to be a doctor. And he says, Coach, the reason these lads are like this is where they come from, they could be feeding up to 100 people. And it never dawned on me, because I've never had to do that. You know, okay, I was from a working class Liverpool background, but I was never starving, ever. You know, I always had what I wanted, which was a ball. I got a pair of boots every September, you know, for the new season. So I was poor in a working class, but not poor as in an African village class. And I realised that some of these lads are literally playing for their whole family. They're playing for, and their family is huge in many cases. So possibly that was a reason for their selfishness. So these are the things that go on at professional level. Maybe not at the EPL, you know, but they do go on. There's a lot of professional football going around the world. In Asia, you know, these lads are playing for their life. And a lot of lads are playing for their mortgage. So that's what makes me laugh when I hear about people talk about, oh, our performance mattered. Our philosophy is this, and we don't care about the results as long as the way we play. Well, they're not usually in a job long enough to say that in Asia, because the boss, the bloke, and you've got to remember that as an employee, you're an employee as a coach now. The game has changed as much. The person at the top might be a committee, it might be one owner, he might be super intelligent in his own business and a megalomaniac in football. He might be a nutcase, you know, and I've had them all. I had one bloke ring me at 3 a.m. in the morning. We've got to play this team. And I said, look, this team will win. Because he said, how do you know? I said, because, well, you've just given me 12 players. We were playing 4-4-3 with his team. You know? And this is 3 a.m. in the morning. And so you have to learn, and that's what you've got to deal with. And then I often get asked, what should a coach now learn to do? Well, the two new things for me, or maybe three, look at analysis better. Number one is manage upwards, because you're going to have to deal with the person above you. Number two, manage social media. It's not going to go away. It's only going to get bigger, and it can destroy you. I was sacked on Facebook in one club. I found out, I opened my Facebook up, Derby has been sacked, and the president speaking to his followers, telling them that I'd been sacked, but he hadn't told me yet.
Wow.
You know, so, and then of course, the third one is use analysis tools, which, you know, you'd be stupid not to, but use them for what you can benefit from. And again, all this is towards one thing, winning games of football. If you're teaching young kids youth development, yeah, fine. I agree. You don't just go for the win. You look at developing the player. But if you're doing it for your living in a top league, you've got to look at winning. Winning is political power for coaches. I often tell young coaches that if you're winning, that's the time to say to the president or the committee man, hey, we need some more balls. Or look, the lads need to go for a spa today. Can we afford it? You know, and that's what you're looking at. And then if you're losing, you keep your mouth shut. You say nothing because no point. Because the first thing you'll get is, oh, they're not winning. They don't deserve it. And, you know, things like this. Again, another reality of professional football at the not highest level is I've had analysts come to me and say, can I employ them? Well, I'd love to employ them, but I've got this thing called a budget. And do I have a better striker or a better goalkeeper or an analyst? And I know where I'm going to go, I'll be honest, because one of them I guarantee keeping my job. The analyst may keep my job, but he might not. The only off-field member who I really insist on is the physio, because he keeps my best players fit and on the pitch, which all that matters. It sounds ruthless. It sounds awful, but I think I've learned it's called reality, because you won't survive if you don't win, particularly in the layer. I mean, I suppose it happens at every level now, but that's what you're going to face. Winning keeps your job, and that's what you're in for. Otherwise, you'll be doing something else soon.
No, it's very true, and as we can all see, and we all know that the lifespan of a head coach, manager, or whatever title they've got, is getting less and less as the years go by.
Absolutely.
I can't remember which manager this quote is attributed to, but it might have been Ron Atkinson, but it's probably been said by many. Is the only thing that you're guaranteed when the only thing that's missing off your contract when you sign as a manager of a club is the date that you're leaving. And
it can be for stupid reasons as well. You know, it can be usually because you lose. Let's be honest. But it can be you upset the chairman. Or you might even have upset the chairman's wife by not saying hello to her. You know, these things. And of course, the other one, which is where it does make me laugh about some of the analysts that I've come across, not all, some. One lad sent me something and he didn't realise that the game was fixed. But he analysed all these technical errors the players made and the errors I'd made, but he didn't know, and I didn't know at the time until later, the game was fixed by some of my players. They were giving free kicks away in certain areas. You've got to remember that it goes on. Let's be honest. Fixing goes on. It probably doesn't go on at the EPL because they can't afford to pay the players to fix a game. But it has gone. Don't let anyone just say it's Asia either. It's going on all over Europe. Italy are famous for it, obviously, at the highest level. And it's not a black and white issue, fixing. Don't let anyone kid you that. You know, if someone says to you, you're going to fix a game for 10 grand, and you say no, and they turn around and say, well, does your mum still go shopping at Tesco's at 10 o'clock? Or does your daughter go to this primary school? And then you know what they mean. You suddenly think, hey, that I've got to do it. And once you do it once, they grab you. I mean, it's a complex area, fixing. And I look at some of the analysis, and the good ones are very, very good at it. The goalkeeper lets you through his legs. Don't forget that. He's just a bad goalkeeper. But, you know, the good goalkeepers stand slightly off where they should be, ever so slightly, because the good strikers can see the gap and ping it in. Or they make a good save, but don't hold it. They palm it back into the path of another striker, and it gets knocked in. And, you know, I'll be honest, I've seen this happen at a World Cup. I saw a team, you know, give away two goals, I think, by fixing. And later you saw that team hadn't been paid by their federation. So you can see what was happening. And again, you get the other area where you don't realise it, but you can still win a game and make a fortune on fixing by spot fixing, by who takes the first throw in. Is someone going to get a red card in the 70th minute? You know, in that block and thing, because there's so many gambling methods now that you can win a game and fix, which is, it's awful. It really is. And as a coach, it's so frustrating because you work your guts out all week and you suddenly think, why have I bothered? Because, you know, it's... And the other thing you don't see is when you're winning, cause, and I've won games because of fixed games. I didn't know until later. The classic, because you don't see it. You think your team is playing well. You don't notice the other team's mistakes. And the classic example was I was coming off at half-time in a Malaysian Super League game. And a foreigner, English lad, came up, walked past me and said, from the other team, you're going to win 2-0, Steve. I said, how do you know? He says, they don't think I can speak Malay, but I can. I can understand enough, you know. So, bang, 0-0 at half-time. We scored in the 84th and the 89th. And that basically meant that we were never going to score a third, wasn't enough time, and we didn't need to. And they weren't going to score. They knew that. So the two goals spread, we won by. And because it was a spread betting thing. So I didn't, if he hadn't told me, I would have just thought it was a late win and been delighted with it. And my lads didn't know anything about it. My lads played as though it was going to be a win, but the other team had sold the game. You know, so it's complex. You know, what one lad said to me once, coach, we don't get paid to play for the country. In fact, we lose money because I've got to go away from home and I can't do this and I can't do that. We're going to get beat anyway, so we may as well get beat by a certain score or do certain things, and at least we'll get some money to take home to our family. So it's a complex, you know. And to put it in perspective, because a lot of it is money. When Lau played South Korea, one of my lads who was quite bright, he worked out that he saw what Son Heung-min got for a week at Spurs. And he added up the total salary of my whole 11 for a year, and it was less than what Son Heung-min got for a week.
Wow.
So that's, you know, the lad who marked Son Heung-min, who couldn't kick him, tried, was on $200 a month. That was what he was on at his club. And he was doing a second job, getting fruit from across the border and fruit and vegetables from across the border in Thailand, bringing it over, you know, say 4 a.m. in the morning, coming back. He then had to go sleep for a couple of hours. He'd come training at night. We could only train with Lau at night because I couldn't get most of my first 11 off work because they were still working. And we're going to World Cup qualify at home against Korea. My captain couldn't get off work till 12 o'clock on match day. And I had to write a letter to the government, well, he was a government servant, to get him off work at 12 o'clock. So you know, this is what you see some of these big scores and you think, this is why, you know. When we played Kuwait came in a private jet. They landed in Laos on their own private jet. They got back, you know, we'd played Kuwait. They got back to Laos before we did. So... Normally you get back right, you know, before the opposition, yeah. But they got back before because they had a private jet and flew straight there. They had extra days rest. We had to take commercial flights and we had stopovers because our commercial flights, we couldn't go for the most expensive ones. We had to go for the best economic ones. And also all your players are in economy. They're not in business. Forget it. And I used to work on that view that if they were in economy, I'd go in economy as well. Because I felt that was the right thing to do. I hated myself at time for those principles, but I think you've got to do it if you want respect for the players. And the reality is, you know, you want your best striker, your 6'5" goalkeeper, to have a leg room as well. You know, you don't want to. It's more important he gets it than me. So you know, they're the realities of coaching, even at the highest level. And that's where, you know, some of the analysis that I've had doesn't understand those things that go on behind the scenes. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't understand that. You know, you can't take that. But that is why some of the analysis is laughable when they don't know what's happened in the real world.
No, indeed. So, Steve, when you think back to those freezing cold mornings and afternoons on Sheffield Wednesday's training ground working with the youth kids, do you have any regrets about travelling the world and gaining all this knowledge and insight to how football works in different parts of the world?
Well, I always remember that first thing I was taught at Sheffield, because it was freezing, was you put a pair of socks on, then you put a couple of, you put a plastic bag over the sock, then you put another pair of socks on. The plastic bags keep the heat in. You learn things about that in football. I mean, the good thing is, footballers are footballers, no matter what their language, whatever their race, whatever their religion, they don't matter, they're footballers. They take the mickey out of each other. You know, you get good lads, you get bad lads, but most are good lads, I'll be honest. You know, the dressing room is irreplaceable, but I've got to be honest, it's a little bit nicer coaching in the heat than it is in the cold. And I read Capello. He wrote, if you read Capello's book, he said something like, you can't coach in Scotland. He said, because it's so windy and cold, players cannot concentrate. And he was right. You know, if you've got players who are warm and comfortable, they will listen to your work. They'll do repetitions of work. If it is 2 degrees and it's absolutely pouring down and it's horizontal because of the wind, all you can do is keep players moving. It's so hard to actually coach and stop and talk to them. You've just got to keep them moving. So, yeah, I mean, as much as it was great with the Sheffield lads and some went on to be good pros, which is, you know, you're happy with, because you see some of your players going on to great things. But you know, I got coaching in Thailand was a pleasure. Coaching with people like Brian Robson and Peter Reid, absolute delight. Real good football men. You know, some of the stuff they teach you about football and what goes on at the highest level was fascinating. So you know, no regrets. I'm not a multi-millionaire. Could have been if it fixed games, but I would never do that.
Just a multi-millionaire, Steve, or was it not?
Okay. I'm a multi-millionaire in dong, Vietnamese dong.
Fantastic.
Where there's 30,000 to a pound.
Yeah.
But the best advice I was given as well is by an Asian administrator, a fellow called Haji Ahmed Mohammed, who was my manager. The manager is an important person in Malaysia. You were the coach, he was the manager. And if they're mad, it killed you. So many coaches got sacked because of the mad manager. This guy was good, intelligent. He said to me, be like bamboo. He said, and I looked at him, he said, bend occasionally. Because I'd gone in, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And he said to me, look, if you do this and do that, you'll be gone. It'll be somebody else in a few weeks. Do what you believe in. You know, like bend, but never break. Like my principle, I'll never fix a match, no matter what. I've never fixed a match, never got involved in it. But sometimes you've got to think, well, if I do this, you know, and I give you an example, my star striker in Malaysia, great lad, lovely fella, international footballer, scored goals, rings me up and says, coach, I can't come training. I said, why? He said, my mum said I've got to take her shopping. I said, you're joking, you're an international footballer. He says, coach, no matter what you say, no matter how much you fine me, my mum says I've got to take her shopping because my dad's not well. I've got to go. And he went. And I had to learn that. Well, it was stupid to fine him because it was beyond his control. He couldn't do. My centre-back was an Indian boy in Malaysia. Again, good pro, wonderful player. He told me 3 months ahead, coach, I'm getting married on that day. And I looked and I said, we're playing the team on this now. I said, you can't get married in season. I said, I know your future wife. She wouldn't mind. She was a great girl. He says, coach, it's nothing to do with me or her. It's our families. They have agreed that the numbers are right. The horoscope is right.
Yeah.
I am getting married at that time on that day. And hey, there was nothing we could do about it. So you had to learn to bend your principles, sway with them, go with them. Don't snap them, but you'll survive. Because the blokes that go in and say, we're going to do it like this, we did in England, we do this in Germany, do this in Brazil, whatever, they're usually back in those countries quite quick.
I think that's a really valuable lesson there in general as well. And there's, again, not just in football, not just in coaching, but in any walk of life that, yeah, you've got your principles, but then those principles have to be applied in context to the culture, the situation, the life that you're in at that time. And, I know for myself, for example, having moved to Spain sort of 5 or 6 years ago, I now work in a slightly different way, shall we say, to when I did when I was working in London in a tech firm, et cetera, because you wouldn't survive in out here if you adopt exactly the same mentality to how you approach things. So yeah, I think the bamboo analogy is absolutely fantastic. I've had to bend a lot personally over the last 5 years, but it's been worth it. And you learn a lot from listening to how things are done in a different way.
Local knowledge, you know, you cannot ignore local knowledge. I mean, the classic local knowledge is be careful what you eat. And people laugh and say, oh, you know, come on, I can do a spice, you know, I like a vindaloo occasion, ice curry. But I went to, when I was in Calcutta, I ate with the players because I thought it was the right thing to do. I made a mistake because Delhi Belly isn't just going to the toilet. It's literally, I slept that night in the toilet on a blanket and a pillow because I couldn't afford to risk being more than a meter away. And pain is beyond description of when you get sick with that illness in India. So I learned you don't do this. You know, you certainly learn, you know, what how to be sensible. And another example was I was talking to an administrator in Fiji. I was working in Fiji. And I said, and the Fiji, everyone thinks is wonderful hotels, beaches. It is on the outside, but in the middle is massive poverty. And I said, oh, it's terrible, you know, about the poverty and what can we do and all that. And he just looked at me and said, win games. He said, you think you can change Fiji's poverty overnight or in your contract time? He said, you can't. He says, but you can make the people feel happy. And if you can make the people feel happy, that's the best you can do. Mm. And he was spot on, absolutely spot on. You know, it's, you know, you're not going to change the world. You know, the other good advice I got was learn the language. You know, you can't be fluent. Let's be serious. You can't be fluent in 20 languages. But it does not. Firstly, you got to say please and thank you. That breaks the ice. It also helps as well that if you can understand the language, you know what they're talking about you. And you let them know you understand it, they won't talk as much behind.
Yeah.
That's another way. But it is important. It's important to say to a young lad who's 18 who can't speak English, you know, maybe sometimes can't even read and write, who says to you, say, well done, you know, and that really, in his language, and that gets through to him. He understands. And also, when players are tired, they can't translate themselves, even those who are reasonably comfortable in two languages. You know, if you can speak in their language, they can process it quicker when they're tired, you know. So it's language is really useful. Because then that, again, goes towards your quality of your translator. You know, you've got to have a good translator in some countries. In Vietnam, I went through a number of translators who were useless because this is 2001 and very few people spoke English. None of my team spoke English at all, not a word. You know, the only words they knew were things like Liverpool, Man United. That's the only words they knew.
Yeah.
Power of football again. And an example, one day, I said to the translator, tell him to stick it to the far post, all across it to the far post. Next minute, the balls are going, bing, bing, and the belting towards the corner flag. And I said, what are you doing? What do you say to them? And she said, she was a girl who could translate perfectly, but couldn't understand football. She said, you said hit it to the furthest stick. The furthest stick is that one on the corner over there. And I thought, oh, God. And I realized, and you can't use slang, you know, and because... Yeah. You use slang, you're lost. I said to her one day, we were under pressure. I said, tell them to flipping welly it. Wasn't flipping, as I'm sure you can gather. And she looked at me, the next minute, she's on a little electronic calculator. I said, what are you doing? Because normally she was dead scared quick. And she says, I know what flipping is. And she looked at me and said, I actually quite like it. She says, but she says, what is this welly? I do not know this welly. It is not in the book. You know. So you learn, you don't use welly. You tell them, get it away quicker, you know, things like that. So the other things you learn by mistakes. God, my God, I should be a genius, the mistakes I've made.
Fantastic. Well, Steve, I guess my final question for you for today really is, when's the book coming out? Because I get this clear feeling that we've only touched on a few little things here, and there's stories and more stories that would fill many pages in some kind of autobiography. Have you got any plans for anything like that?
Well, there is a bloke, a fellow called Anthony Sutton, Jakarta Casual his name is, and he's written a couple of books on Indonesian football. He's about 70% down the line of writing one. As I said to him, it can't include everything because my mum's still alive and she battered me as a CEO. I said, and you know, especially the Thailand chapter, you can't say about those things. But and so we're sticking just purely to football, you know, those stories. But I mean, it's yeah. I mean, I work on the view that there are better coaches than me unemployed, and there are bigger con men than me who are millionaires and I'm not, you know. So I don't worry anymore. I never say I am the best coach, because I don't think there's a best coach. I think there's only the coach with the best players. You know, and you know, it's true. I would love to see Guardiola with Stoke. You know, I mean, I'm sure he'd make Stoke better, but he probably wouldn't win anything. You know, and to be fair, I've heard Guardiola say the same thing. You know, he's not stupid. I heard him say, you know, what someone asked him what made him a great coach, and he just looked up to the crowd and said, Lionel Messi. You know, which I thought was a wonderful answer. You know.
No, indeed. Well, look, Steve, I think that brings us to the end of today's podcast. And it has been an absolutely educational and, to use your word from earlier, enjoyable journey. Thanks ever so much for all your stories and all your insight as well from the experience you've garnered from your globetrotting over the years. I would really
good luck to any young kid. Yeah, good luck to any young analyst. Make it relevant. Make it practical. Keep playing as long as you can. It's the most important thing. Any young coach, the same. Play as long as you can. It's the best job in the world. Coaching's the second best job. And maybe analyst is third best job.
Fantastic. Well, I'd really like to do this again at some point to cover some of the other stories that won't have come out from today's conversation. But thank you very much for your time. Folks, listeners, thanks for joining us today. I've been Chris Darwin. We've been talking to Steve Darby. Of course, if you want to get more of our podcast, make sure you subscribe on whatever app you are listening to us on. And don't forget to head over to the website, totalfootballanalysis.com, to catch up on all the latest content that we're putting out there at the moment. Once again, Steve, thank you for your time. And folks, we'll be back again very soon with our next podcast.